We would continue where we stopped yesterday, and one of the things we looked at sockets, as well as the possibility that different programming environments, be it C or be it Java, that actually supports or provides some library functions which facilitate the programming using sockets, and thus makes life a lot easier for the programmer on the one hand. On the other hand, also reduces the possibility that as a programmer you make some programming mistakes, because most of the complexity is basically hidden in library functions. The next aspects we want to look with bidirectional communication is to look at call semantics, and we especially consider the communication part, and the not now any errors in the sense of programming the server or programming executable code of the client. Therefore, in that sense, we concentrate on situations related to the distribution, and one of the problems are basically the loss of messages, and there could be the loss of a request message or the loss of answer messages, but also the other possibilities which may take place, that somehow the server crashes, in that sense the sender crashes, or the receiver crashes, in that sense the client, or the reverse, whoever is sender and receiver. And the point is that if lost messages, like lost request and answer messages, can always be detected, then bidirectional communication is reliable. Also here, reliable communication that means loss of request and answer messages can be detected. And that's an important aspect, because sometimes the for some situations it's not really to be it's undecidable. In that sense, did the server crash or did the message get lost? And therefore, in that sense, it's necessary to have some redundancy. The different call semantics which are related to these losses, as well as server crashes or client crashes, there are basically four different types of call semantics, and the first one we can look at is the at least once semantics. Here, the situation we have, just to look at at the example, you have sending the request, the receiver receives it, executes the function associated with it, sends the answer, and the answer gets lost due to some kind of buffer problem or network problem. And therefore, the sender runs into a timeout, then it basically initiates the request again. So here, that's a request. Here, it sends a copy of the request again. This is executed once more, and then the answer is sent back again, and this time it is successful. We can, when we look at it here, first first and second execution may be different. Because here we can see that basically the receiver executes the request once more. And it doesn't care if it has seen it or not. And that would mean that if the first and the second execution are performed, it could be the first and the second execution maybe deliver different results. And therefore, that at least one semantics makes sense for something like item potent requests. And therefore, in that sense, then you would always get the same result. And the sender can be sure that there's no variation if it sends the requests once, twice, or three times. Because usually what you have is you don't have after it, you don't just send a second or have a second try. Usually you have multiple tries if there's some communication problem. And the next type of call semantics is the exactly once. And here we have again the example here. We send a request. This is lost. Here you have a timeout. Send the request again. Then you execute it, you want to send the answer back, that's lost. Here you have another timeout, then you send the request again. And now the important part of it is here. You don't have a second execution. After the first execution, you save the request as well as the results. And the request could be just basically the ID of the request which was sent here. You put it in a table, and when the second request comes, it has to be marked as a copy of a previous request. Therefore, it has to use the same request ID. And when it uses the same request ID, then basically here the receiver checks if it has seen the request again already, looks into its list of current requests, takes the results out, and then ships the answer or the previously produced results back. And therefore, in that sense, we can say request needs unique ID to recognize copies. And the second thing is we have here an acknowledgement. And the acknowledgement means on the receiving side, delete entry in table. Now you can make the argument and say, well, what happens if the acknowledgement is lost? Do you just accumulate a huge number of requests and the associated results? Well, there are two options. If you don't receive an acknowledgement, for example, if the receiver receives a subsequent request with another ID, but from the same sender, it can assume that the previous request was was received correctly. I mean, the the results of the request. It's something similar what you use in flow control in computer networks, where you don't really acknowledge individual packages, but you acknowledge one package, and then automatically all previous packages are acknowledged automatically. And that's what you do here. If you receive another request, you assume that the previous request was already received, or the answer from the previous request was received correctly, and the sender does not send it twice again. The other possibility could be to basically use something like a timeout, and then the timeout must be set in a way that the assumption would be correct, that there's no repeated copy of the request sent again. But that's a little bit, difficult. How long do you set the interval, the timeout interval, to delete here the entry? The point is here, with the exactly once, the attempt is here in all cases, the attempt is to make the request be executed. And therefore, sender as well as receiver take all the effort to get the request executed. This comes with a lot of additional effort because of sending back and forth, and that possibly even if the sender on this side crashes at some point and this one tries to get the results back, therefore in that sense it has to repeatedly try to deliver the answer to the sender. A variation of this exactly once semantics, which is a lot less strict, is the possibility of the at most once semantic. Here, it's if everything works okay, you have the exactly once behavior. I mean, here in case of success, it corresponds to exactly once semantics. But what comes here, you have here the situation that you do it at most once. And the things how you can achieve it, you would have the same thing is that that possibly you have not a try until it is executed. It could be that after the first attempt it was not executed, or the sender did not receive the answer. It tries it a second time. It tries it a third time, and after the third time, it basically gives up. And therefore, in that sense, for the at most once semantics, you also need this table, because it could be that there's a second copy of the original request sent to the receiver. And you have to avoid that the request is here executed multiple times. That means here you also need a table in case you retransmit requests. You could also say, well, you don't make any retransmission. You try it once, and if you're not successful, or if you don't know if you're successful, you don't retransmit it again. And therefore, in that sense, you don't run into the problem. And in that case, if you don't do any retransmission, it would mean you don't even need a table to handle that, because you never get a copy of the original request, because you don't do a retransmission. Or you could also package the whole thing as part of transaction, and there you have the atomic behavior, which means once or not at all behavior. Therefore, you don't really have the situation also that you execute it multiple times. It's just once or not at all. And there are a number of distributed frameworks which provide you the possibility to put requests under the label of a transaction, and then you basically run the requests as well as the answers as part of the transaction, and then you have the same situation. Either you abort the transaction, then the request is not executed at all, or when you are in a successful side, you can commit it, and then you have once you execute the request only once. The one thing is here, the last semantics, that's basically in some sense a variation of the at least once semantics. At least once semantics have ya the situation that it could be that the request is executed multiple times. And a very simple situation would be that you send a request, and one point is here that you have a pointer pointing to that, to the first block. Then the action or the operation of the request would be to increase the block pointer. After the first execution, it's executed here. After the second copy, it's basically executed here. The point is here, you see the difference in the at least one semantic here. The first execution, you are here. The second, you are here. The third, you are here. Last semantics could be that something like you have a variable and you put a value in it. And the last semantics could be that you write something like the time into the variable. And if you receive the first original copy of the request, you put the current time in it. You get the second request, the second copy of it, you put the new time in it. And then the third one, you put yet another time in it. Therefore, in that sense, you at the end, you have the basically the time of the last request in it. And all the previous ones are basically overwritten. That's only a very simple example. You can come up with a lot more complex examples. But the point, what I wanted to say is that the previous request copies are basically from the effect overwritten, and only the last one counts. And it could be that every copy has the same effect, then it doesn't matter if the first one is written in it, the second one, or the third one is written in it, because you always have the same value. But if the parameters change, or if there are some additional side effects associated with it, it could be that it really matters if it's the first copy, second copy, or third copy. Good. That's here for the call semantics. And here is another paradigm which is rather trivial. The producer-consumer, or some call it fire and forget. The point is here, the producer only invokes the consumer and does not expect any results. Also here, producer does not expect results. And where this type of behavior makes sense, for example, statistics. If you have samples and the producer is the sensor getting the samples and now send it to some statistic program and then basically sends samples in short intervals. And it does not really get any feedback if it was received or if it was lost or if it was somewhat garbled or if it was received correctly. Therefore, in that sense, the producer does not really care of it. Special cases, Unix pipes, you have the situation, the producer writing into the pipe and then the consumer reading out of the pipe. If you look at Unix pipes, you can either realize it or implement it as part of a file, that it pipes it into a file, or you can even program it in memory. You have something like memory pipes where you have a certain section of your address space where then a process pipes in or a thread pipes in and the other thread basically can take it out of it. And there, if the pipe is full, the producer can't write anything in anymore. If the pipe is empty, then the consumer can't take anything out. And usually pipe mechanism was a very common way of interacting between processes. And most of the problems came then up when there were locks on it and when a process somewhat forgot or the lock of a process was not really released anymore, then the other process could not really access the file anymore. Here the next part is client-server model. That's what you really find in a lot of web applications. And here the use for the interaction, also here use of remote invocation send. And the point is here that basically the client sends something, waits until it gets the answer. And therefore, in that sense, you have this request answer interaction between these partners. And this handshaking, as I mentioned, and an important part of it is also the trend in system software, and especially if you think of operating systems. And therefore, what you have is here in operating systems, you would have something like your kernel, and then here you have a whole bunch of services. And additionally, you have like applications which may be used by or initiated by the regular user. So here, you would have applications. And the point is here, these services use request answer interaction. Therefore, you try to put as much as possibly out of the operating system kernel into these service components, and then they interact with it, with each other in a client-server behavior or a client-service behavior. And the point is here, you might have a service which is a client of another service. And therefore, in that sense, this service is here a client of that second service. And they use this request answer scheme. And you have certain things in the kernel in it, and usually you try to put it into a microkernel. You put, for example, things like in it access the main memory and the protection of main memory sections, or the process intercommunication. You put these types of things in it. But from the memory management, like the selection of the page, which has to be put out of the main memory because no frame is free, that you would, this whole selection process, you would put as part in a strategy service. And that does either use as like least recently used or first in, first out of pages or whatever strategy it uses. But that memory management part you would not have in as part of the kernel. You would put out in a service. Here is in a service component. And that's typically that system software may use this client-server organization of it. The other thing is this service-oriented architecture. Therefore, in that sense, that's we have now for a number of years. It's something which was propagated, especially for enterprise applications, especially for large enterprise applications. To have not these monolithic applications, which very heavy weight applications, which are very difficult to maintain, and to move to something like a service-oriented architecture, to have basically something like a modularized software with a lot of component. And component, that's something like enterprise Java beans or things like that. Therefore, we don't talk about individual objects or one or two objects. It's basically these components are somewhat much larger. They encompass a number of objects within it. And the point is here, the goal is here, the reusability, as we hear, the reusability of software. You you move it out into individual components, and then the components can invoke each other using the client service behavior. An important aspects associated with SOA is this loose coupling. Therefore, these services or client and server are dynamically coupled, or dynamically bound. Therefore, in that sense, you don't have the situation of building the application, the whole distributed application, and then run it. It's more like you build the individual components, start the components, and then they try to find each other using directory services, trying to import the interfaces, and then interact using the request answer scheme. And the other important part is each service must manage its own data. Therefore, in that sense, they are somewhat autonomous. And the other thing is, in most cases, you use remote invocation. I mean, that could be RMI if you're working in the Java environment. It could be the CORBA interaction if you're more in a CORBA environment, or it can be also, if you'd use C#, the environments, basically what .NET provides as remote invocation. Therefore, in that sense, you have pretty much of a flexibility. Therefore, here, SOA provides an abstract architectural approach. You can have multiple types of implementation. And for example, web services is an implementation of the SOA concept, and here using internet technology. And the point is here, you use HTTP, you use SOAP, you use UDDI for a registry service, and also use WSDL as a description of web services, which you might which you may use then here to import an interface. And that's an important part of the dynamic binding. You can dynamically import the interface. And in the previously part, in the before, let's say, the SOA times, you built the application components statically, like compiling and linking, and then establishing it at the different runtime environments and have it basically pre-configured. And you could not really import new interfaces. You could only import new interfaces in the case if you recompiled it, relinked it, and reconfigured it, and started it again to get the new interface behavior. You have three important roles: requestor, provider, and registry. With web services, we will look much more on into it, how they are implemented, and other specific parts. There's a whole section on it, what we'll look at it. Good. The examples for servers, certainly servers manage shared resources. The problem, what you have is, when the server crashes, the resources are no longer available. On the other hand, if the server is a little bit too small, then it may become a bottleneck, and therefore it would make sense to come up with something like a fault tolerant, or like a redundant server layout, which basically can on one hand tolerate certain server crashes, and which also could tolerate like large performance or large request increases. Therefore, you have something like a scalability of performance. And especially in the cloud, where you could dynamically add new servers, allows you a very dynamic reaction to a situation like server crashes or bottlenecks due to increase of requests. HTTP, I don't really have to say very much. Everybody who knows it, it's a stateless protocol, uses TCP sockets, and the well-known error codes 404 or 401, which in a normal life you get reasonably often on different web pages. The other aspect, peer-to-peer model, there the point is here, we can say before we have the situation that the client had the client role, the server had the server role, and you had a clear distinction between the roles. Here you don't have a distinction between client and servers. Therefore, in that sense, every entity here is a client as well as a server. And therefore, in that sense, it has certainly the application code running. And on the other hand, there's also here coordination code. Usually the clients, or it's better to call it the peers talk directly to one another. And in that sense, there's not really always if two in the regular client server where the client only talks to the server. Here, everybody talks to each other. And now you need something like these coordination code, basically to coordinate or to synchronize between peers to achieve consistency. And for example, consistency if shared data are manipulated or stored by several peers, like let's say by this peer, and this peer, then the coordination code has to synchronize that if on one machine the data are modified, then also the modification is propagated to the other peers. And therefore, in that sense, that's what I mean here with coordination code, to synchronize the environment between the affected peers. On the other hand, also peer management. It has to know who belongs to the peer group. And the point is here that, for example, at the beginning here, this peer knows of this peer and this peer as a way to contact. Then this peer goes away because usually peers are user-maintained environments. Therefore, the user decides to turn off its machine. And then this peer says, well, I want to have at least contact with two peers. Then it starts to get in contact with that peer as an alternative to that one. Therefore, in that sense, this coordination code is also necessary to provide this peer group management. And a brief distinction between client-server environments and peer-to-peer. The point is here, servers are centrally maintained, like an organization. And usually clients have fewer resources than server. And especially if you think at the file servers here, that they have lots of main memory and lots of disk storage, it's certainly more than, for example, your laptop has. And it also might have faster network connectivity. On the other hand, if you look at peers, usually the peers have similar resources. While it could be that some peer lives in an area where the connectivity is not as good, and other peers have, for example, a 16,000 DSL connection, the other one can be happy if it has a 1,000 DSL connection. Therefore, in that sense, there still might be a significant distinction between the peers, but in a sense, there is a similar amount of resources associated with peers. The peers communicate directly And for example, if you use Skype, on the one hand, you have a central server which maintains information about the Skype users. But on the other hand, if you do a direct interaction, then it goes directly between the involved participants. You have a number of issues associated with it, like group management and peer discovery, who belongs to the peer group. You have problem data location. If you have a server, a file server, you know the files are at the server and you contact it. Here you need some kind of data discovery, asking other peers, do you have that file available? And if you go back, the first large peer to peer system was Napster with respect to the exchange of audio files. There it was basically an interaction, do you have that song available? And then if you have it, can you give it to me? And then the peer would download it. And here, therefore, it's important the finding, the location, as well as here, data discovery. The other thing is you need a reliable, efficient file exchange. As in peer groups, files are often stored on multiple peers, and then the requesting peer can then decide which other peer to contact. For example, it decides on, well, this peer is much easier to reach, therefore I have a much better line to the other peer. I download it from that peer and I ignore the other peers, even if they have the same file. And, well, certainly security, privacy, anonymity and trust. Certainly if you download files from another peer, well, you have to trust it. Is that a file which you want to store on your environment, or you don't? Because, I mean, you basically copy from some peer, and therefore you need some kind of a trust relationships between peers, that you say, well, from that peer I take something, from the other peer I don't take it. And sometimes it would be rather difficult to maintain. For group management, there are a whole number of approaches, like this distributed hash tables, or canned short, or can, and so on. And there's actually a course, I think it's in the group from Professor Kahle, where they basically look at all the protocols and all the details of peer-to-peer interaction. I just wanted to mention it here as a way to have a distinction between client and server and peer-to-peer. A quick rundown. Napster was one of the first peer-to-peer application. It was not a poor, as you hear, not a poor peer-to-peer application. And it had still a central server. And that central server here maintained the music list, where to find on which peer the songs. And here, if somebody searched for a song, it interacted with the server. There it got a number of addresses for peers, and then it selected one peer, and then it contacted when it could, and if one couldn't, then it just contacted another one. The technical issues was that you had clients' systems coming and going. This one had the information where things to find, but it was not required that all the clients were always accessible. if they were online or they were offline. The problem were firewalls, especially if you tried it with organizations. And depending in which area you were, and if you had just a small ISDN connection, the download was basically pretty long to do that. And especially that they had slow upload links. And even if you use DSL, the download is rather fast. The upload is usually much slower than the download. And the other point was that clients, or here we would say peers, unexpectedly withdrew the file, and then it took a while until here the server was updated that the file was not available here anymore. But the main point were the legal issues. And when the system was launched, then the Napster programmers, they thought they out of the loop and they don't have any legal problems. And their reasoning was the server only has information about clients or peers. I mean, here with clients, I always mean here peers. And they said, well, on our central server, we only provide information about peers. We don't store any song or any pirated song. We don't store anything. We only store information about peers. And if that information or if that link happens to be an illegal song, then it's supposed to be the problem of the person who maintains the peer. That was their reasoning. And they basically went to court, and the court closed down Napster because it said they facilitate theft, and especially because of the links or the information about who stores what. And that was already the reasoning that Napster was basically closed down and completely disappeared. When they were ruled illegal, I think they had approximately already 15 million users worldwide, and they did not really exist that long. I mean, it was a rather short time until the music industry tried to get through the courts to get them closed down. That was one of the reasons. The next one, Nutella tried to eliminate completely the legal or their central server. Therefore, they don't have a central server in the sense of that the central server stores information on which peer you find what resource or what object. This one, they only have something like, where do I have it? They have websites where they list all the machines which belong to the Nutella network. They don't store any information about what is stored there. What information or what resource is stored on their machine. They only have information who belongs to it and who belongs not. And therefore, in that sense, they don't really have a central server maintaining meta information about the resources. And the approach is here the following, that if a computer or if your machine wants to join the Nutella network, you basically would contact the website, a well-known website, where a number of these peers are listed, and then you download them in your environment, and these ones you can use then for subsequent occasions. When you try now to join or do something in the in the Nutella network, you start to building a connection to three or four machines belonging to the Nutella network. And now you send a request for a file name. Say, I'm interested in a certain file, and you specify the current hop count. That means certainly the hop count here when you started, it's zero. But when one of your neighbors receives it, it first of all checks if it has it. And if it has it, it responds to the requester that it has the file. It increments the hop count, and then it propagates it to its neighbors. Therefore, in that sense, it does not really stop when the file is found. It basically stops when the maximum hop count is reached. And, it could be the maximum hop count can be decided on 4 or 5 or some kind of reasonable value. And then the original requester and or Nutella peer basically get a number of answers back from peers which have the file, and then the original requester decides which peer to contact and download the file. And therefore, in that sense, it's certainly it's you can say it's self-healing, because if you don't get a connection with one neighbor, it has information about other neighbors or other peers, and it tries to contact them. And it's highly interconnected. Also here, highly interconnected. The disadvantage, certainly if you search for files, you have the request multiplied, because it's propagated from multiple peers, and therefore in that sense the original request might be multiplied to 10, 16, 32 times and so on, depending how the maximum hop count is set. And therefore in that sense it's blindingly propagated in the network until the maximum hop count is reached. Therefore, it has some kind of a saturation. And, and that's, I think, all what I wanted to say to that. Other system examples, well, there's BitTorrent, it's providing a communications protocol for file sharing. Then there's eDonkey, and the successor of is Overnet. The one thing what I think is an interesting part, how you do the file naming in eDonkey. And usually if you use other systems, basically they use the file name. And if you do a request, you do a file name matching and find out if the file is there or not. And if the file names match, then it's assumed that's the file you're looking for, and it's provided from the peer. Here, the interesting part of it is here that for files identification, you use MD4 hash checksum, and therefore you look at the content. It could be that you have two files with the same name, but MD4, as here MD4 is different. That means files are different, and files are treated as different files. And therefore, it could also be that some people used different names, like for a song that you or a video file, you store it on your peer, you name it with some certain name, and another one has the same song but uses a different name. Therefore, in that sense, we can always say with peers, it's the administration of the files, the resources, and the environment is completely in your local responsibility and in your local domain. And therefore, you can decide what naming you use for files. And it could be the file names are different, but the MD4 checksum or MD4 hash is the same, then they are treated as the same file. And therefore, in that sense, you don't really search for files with a file name. You search for files which have a certain MD4 hash. And that's, I think, is an interesting part to handle the flexibility of locally using different naming schemes. Gossip approach, that's an interesting part of it. Like it comes from health environments, and there you have these epidemic diseases like influenza. And it basically propagates, let's say, very quickly that people get infected. In health, the goal is to avoid large infection rates. Here in the gossip in computer science, in IT, goal, let's say high infection rate. Well, if we talk about spam, then probably you would try to figure out and see how to avoid a high infection rate. But usually, if you want to use the gossip approach in a positive way. And then you would be interested in a high infection rate. Especially when you think of information dissemination. Now runs out of space. Dissemination. That's an E. And it works informally like this. Supposedly you know something at T0. You pick a friend and tell him. Now two people know. Then each of one picks a friend and tell them. Now four people know, and so on. The point is that it spreads at exponential rate, not quite, but not quite and too upper K, because you have reinfection rates. Therefore, the assumption it's something like in that area, like 1.8 upper K, if you look at K rounds. You have push or pull. Push would be, we know something and we tell it our friends proactively. Pull would mean a friend comes to us and asks us, do you know anything new? And therefore, in that sense, they did some evaluation, and with extremely large groups, then they found out that basically it works best in a combination of push and pull. Push could mean that it's somewhat, if you take a large group of people, it's somewhat restricted to a group of friends which know each other very well, and it does not really propagate to something like remote friends, because they are somewhat locked out of the group communication. Therefore, for them, it would be good to have also the pull included, because then it might be also propagated to other remoter groups. It's quite robust and scalable. If you look in one round, if you lose 50% of packets, 50% of packets are lost. It means one additional round. I mean, that's not very much. Therefore, in that sense, well, if you lose 50%, you just have to have another round. It's certainly difficult to slow down, because when it starts, it's independent of system size, because, I mean, you always have to know the next one. It spreads at log system size, and the network load is linear and to the system size. But on the other hand, it's somewhat difficult with respect to the reinfection rate. And therefore, you would need something also like pull, where you get it also to other areas of your large gossip network. How do you use it, or what for do you use it? Like, I don't know, do I have here? No. I mean, what you can use it for, like data mining. If you try to find the information, or here, multicast data in a robust way, because even if 50% are lost, it does not take very much. Or repair in consistencies in replicas. That would be some possibilities of using the gossip approach. Yes? Certainly, you can receive it from, I mean, basically, it's always troubles to the neighbors. And therefore, certainly, if you have the situation, let's look at here, you have one here, you have a number of people, if this one sends information to that one, and now this one decides on a friend, certainly it doesn't take that one because it received it from that one. But it would, in a second round, it would send it here. This one would decide to send it here. Now, this one has another friend. It sends it to that one again. Therefore, in that sense, the point is here, it propagates the information not only once, it propagates it in each round. And if this one would pick this friend, it would try to send it to this one. This one would say, okay, I already have it. But in the next round, this one would pick another friend and send it to this one. Therefore, you have here some reinfection, and therefore, it's not really 2K, because here, if you look, it would be binary. If you send it always to new people, and therefore it could also be this one picks that friend, and therefore the person who originally triggered it gets it back. And in a sense of, if you look at influenza, in a sense that would mean you are already immune to the new influenza virus. Because, you know, yes, it's basically to one neighbor. It's the point is here, the gossip approach behaves differently. For example, if the individual nodes have lots of information about the network, then the spread might be larger. If, for example, you have that situation that you have lots of nodes, and here you have a group, and this one only, and this one knows that one. And therefore, it's sometimes, and this one started to send it here, this one starts it here, this one starts it here, then it tries to start it here. But the point is here that this one selects this one very late. Therefore, the information travels very late across this network. And it could be that you have something like an reinfection, or if you have something like a limit that you say with a gossip, well, we take the limit that after 10 rounds we stop, because the assumption is, according to the system size, everything would be infected. But it could be that the infection happens mostly here. Then after our K rounds, we would only have infected everything here and nothing here. And that's the reason why it's good if nodes have some knowledge about the topology of the gossip network. And then it could be that this one would rather early distributed across here, because it knows it's the only gateway here. If it doesn't know that, then it might stay here. That's, I didn't understand. It's linear in the sense of, it does not become more with respect to the... therefore, in that sense, if everyone is infected, it's not at the messages. If you think of it, you don't really have more than the number of nodes you have in the network. It's not something like that you can say, well, I have five nodes and I have five of five upper 10 many messages. Therefore, in that sense, you basically stay in the system size. Good. Good, the group model. The group model here, the intention is here, you put a number of processes into a group, especially for fault tolerance. I mentioned it before that we have some redundant server, and if one crashes, the other server takes over its responsibility, and therefore we implement a service by a group of servers. In that sense, they the servers process a shared global problem in a shared environment, and that needs an exchange of information. Now, I'm on the verge of sneezing it, and therefore, if one really slips here, then it's an end of its sleep here. Therefore, what we need is, if we have this group of servers, we have to exchange information to provide group awareness. Therefore, if we have multiple servers, they interact with each other in the sense of, and if they maintain data here, that they can say, well, I did this write operation on the data, it's propagated to the other ones, that they basically up to date what changed. And in that sense, we can say we need the interaction to coordinate the actions within the group. And an important aspect is also the sequence of message delivery to group members, and that can be that messages have to basically processed in the same order, and then the individual servers would be in the same state. And if you process messages in a different order, you might end up in a different state. And the group awareness certainly refers to the membership, who belongs to the group. And if we have a group where you have a coming and going, because you could dynamically create copies of a server. On the other hand, a server could crash and leave the group. Therefore, in that sense, you have a coming and going of servers and of group members. And the other thing is certainly information about past and current actions, which are related to group awareness of the servers. Another aspect is here this publish and subscribe, and it's a distributed event-based system. Also here, distributed event-based systems, and Google is an important example for that. They use this publish and subscribe to update index and other information. What they have, especially the event-based system, what they use, especially for their ad and advertisement. And when you click on it, they use these events and also then count these clicks. And these counted clicks are then, on the other hand, their income again. And here, certainly, as the name already says, you have publishers which publish events to event service. You have subscribers who are interested in particular events, and they register their subscriptions, and you could have like arbitrary patterns. I mean, it could be that an event is defined as something like an expression, like a regular expression. Therefore, if the event matches that expression, then the subscriber is notified. Because otherwise, if you would have a complete match, it would have to subscribe for every type of event. Thus, you could have some kind of pattern matching. And that would make maintenance a lot easier for subscribers. Important is also that the structured events must conform to some certain structure, and therefore you can do some easy matching. And what the publishers publishes with the events and what the subscriber registers with respect to subscriptions, these structures must match, and they have to belong to each other. And it's usually, we can say, one-to-many. It's a one-to-many paradigm. In that sense, you have one publisher, or you have, if you look at one event, one publisher publishes that event, and that might be broadcasted or multicasted to many subscribers. Well, where could you use it for, or you match these subscriptions to it? Characteristics, you could use it in heterogeneous environments. Subscriber and publisher might run in very different environments. The only thing which has to be agreed upon is the structure for the events, which then defines the patterns for the subscriptions. And that's some kind of a generic interface. And then also what you have here is notifications are sent asynchronously. And therefore, it's you don't have a synchronous behavior between the publisher and the subscriber. The task, the publish-subscribe system, basically has to make sure that it has a correct delivery of the event notification. And as I mentioned, Google use it for the event-based the dissemination of events with respect to ad clicks. Google uses it. Where else could you use it? Like stock market, financial services. You can register you're interested in certain stock price, and then if that changes, you immediately get informed. You might have live feeds on like RSS feeds and so on. There's a whole bunch of possibilities where you could use this publish and subscribe environment. The message serialization, that's especially in the context of groups, that we said we want to have to order the messages, and messages of here, if we have, let's say, one sender and multiple receivers, and this one and they belong to the same group. Here, they might be received at different times because here's the network in between, and this one just sends messages, M1, M2, M3, and so on. And for one sender, it's rather easy to handle that. For example, you could basically have a sequence number which is attached to the message, and then delivered to the receiving application according to the sequence number. We could also say, well, the sequence number, we don't care. It's we take the arrival time, or each receiver takes its own criteria and uses the local priority. The problem comes into if you have multiple senders, and here you have different machines, and they all belong to a group. This one sends to, and we have the network in between here, and then we have here another one sending messages to the other ones. And the problem what you have is here, now we don't have this single sequence number anymore, because this one can use a sequence number and this one can use a sequence number. And the possibilities what you can do is that we can have something like a coordinate, or we can have a totally ordered environment. And the totally ordered environment, you can have something like a token. And for people who were in a computer network course, and there exists this token ring. And this token ring basically provides a protocol similar as the Ethernet or the fast Ethernet, but avoiding any conflict of messages. And here it's achieved in a sense of, for example, this one has a token. Now it can send a message. And after it sent the message, it propagates the token to the next sender. This one receives its token, increases the sequence number, and then sends its message. If we have another sender, then it would receive the token, increase the sequence number, and then you get an increased sequence number in a message. That would mean we need always a sent token. And you don't have parallel sends. Everything is serialized depending on the token. You could also have something like if we have two senders and then we have a coordinator, if this one sends their message to the coordinator, these ones are the receivers, so here M1 M2, and then here, and they also sent the message to the receivers here, and in the same way, this one also three times. But the point is here that the message is not delivered; it's buffered, and the coordinator determines then the order, and now it sends basically the information here, like M1 before M2, and that could be achieved. For example, it sends information about M1 using a sequence number, sending information about M2, an incremented sequence number, and so on. And when this information is received here, then actually the messages are delivered in that order to the application. Therefore, before it's only buffered. The other possibilities what we have here is no serialization. Certainly, we deliver it as we want. Loosely synchronous. That means, let me check. That means, for example, if you take the time and we take everything is in intervals, and this would be what we call it the same time, and because I mentioned already before that it's very difficult to synchronize the time across multiple machines. And here we say, well, they are roughly synchronized, but they might diverge in a way. And now we have here, say, a message M1 sent here and a message M2 sent here from different machines. I mean, if they come from the same machine, then that can't really happen. But if they come from different machines, then we say, okay, for us, they are sent at the same time. And then we would, if a message was sent here, we would say, well, that was sent in a later time. If the messages are at the same time, we could basically use for consistent ordering, like use IP address of sender for consistent ordering. And that means that every receiver would treat these messages as the same, in the same time, and they use then the IP address to order it. IP addresses are unique, they are identifiers. And in that sense, you get a consistent ordering. And certainly you can't say the message M1 is before M2. You can only say the message M1 you don't really know, but you get a consistent ordering with respect to the receiving. And virtual synchronous, here you look at causal dependencies. And for example, if you use two senders, S1, S2, if this one sends a message, M1, and this one sends a message, I was out because I had it too long on it. S1. S2, this one sends a message, M1, and also to other areas, this one sends a message, M2, which is also sent to somewhere else. Here we can say M2 depends on M1. Because we can say M2 was sent after S2 saw the message M1. Therefore, there might be a virtual dependency. It's not really an actual dependency, because we can say the message M2 could be completely different from what M1 says. But there's a potential dependency. And therefore, in that sense, if now we have here this C, if this receives M1 and F2, this can decide and say, well, M1 comes for M2 because there's a dependency. And if messages are sent from where there is no causal dependency, then they can be delivered in an arbitrary order. This part of it, we will later see in detail how that works and how that's actually maintained and managed. Therefore, in that sense, I just want to mention it here, and later on we actually talk about it in much more detail. Here, I will